Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
You don't know how precious you are. I am the one who lives with the ocean. You don't know how I am the one. You don't know how I am the one.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer and songwriter Dar Williams has spent the last two decades poking and prodding at the American psyche. Her songs dig into questions about who we are and what we want for ourselves, our community, and our country. It was 20 years ago that she released her breakthrough album, Mortal City, which featured a stellar cast of characters like John Prine singing backing vocals here. Now, Dar Williams is revisiting that album, playing it in its entirety as she tours around the states. She and her band are here, and they're going to start us off with the album's opening track, As Cool As I Am. Here's Dar Williams, live on Soundcheck.
We'll be right back.
Dar Williams and her band live on Soundcheck with As Cool As I Am. 20 years ago, that was the lead-off track on her album Mortal City, now revisiting that album on its 20th anniversary. Dar Williams, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much.
So good to hear you with a band. I mean, every time you've been here, it's been you and the guitar, which is great, but, you know, a song like that needs the band. So let me introduce the members of the band. Bryn Roberts on piano and keyboards and backing vocals. John Jackson playing guitar on that piece. He'll switch off to violin and mandolin in the upcoming songs. And Ethan Eubanks behind our drum kit and some backing vocals as well. So that song, you know, there's a certain kind of verisimilitude to the writing there. I mean, you know, so many of those little scenes, the girl dancing drunk in the club, and they just have, they're like ripped from true life, it seems. Were they, in fact?
Yeah, kind of. You know, that I went to, you know, an artsy school, and so you'd have these women, and this showed up in a few of my songs, you know, you'd have women who were being really self-destructive, and then you'd be with some guy with his playing his head games, and he'd be like, wow, she just looks so cool. And you're like, I wouldn't call that cool. I call that in trouble.
Yeah.
and so that was sort of a distillation of all of those moments when you're like, really? Because, you know, she's not in control of herself or her mind, or is that what you like? So, you know, I was just trying to come up with an epitome of those things.
Yeah. So in touring this album around now on its 20th anniversary, storytelling is a big part of it, not just from your point of view, but your quote-unquote opening acts are writers.
Yeah, you know, I'm working on a book right now that has to do with having toured throughout the country and seeing the way people have, what people have done with towns in the last 20 years, because what I didn't realize in the mid-90s touring was that these were towns that were just coming back from any kind of meltdown. So there were manufacturing, you know, jobs being leaving the country. There were mines shutting down. There were mills shutting down. And then there was the rise of the malls. And so it was a 1-2 punch. Mm-hmm. And in the 90s, people were like, well, let's just plant some daisies and see what happens. You know, these little coffee houses were like, you know, Ted hand lettered the tickets and we don't know what's going to happen or who's going to show up. But then you come back the next year and it's grown and it's grown. And then suddenly they're building art centers and repurposing old factory buildings into beautiful things. And the writers have been documenting it. They've been witnessing it. And a lot of them participate in it. And they have this incredible pride in the cities where they live. And they actually are part of the hauling around of bricks and the wheelbarrows and stuff. So they're going to come and speak on this phenomenon of the mortal city.
Mm. So at that period of time, where many of America's smaller towns, I mean, you've lived in upstate New York for a long time, and, mm-hmm. you know, I've traveled upstate New York for most of my life, and it was pretty depressed. I mean, Hudson River Valley, for all that it has now become, you know, hipster north,
yeah.
was a really depressed place for a number of years.
Yeah, yeah, it was. Well, the thing that I've been working on, what I noticed in towns that I've been to is that, you know, if they'd all gotten together in a big circle and said, hey, like, let's just politically and spiritually make the downtown important and tell people to buy $20 brooms, it wouldn't have worked. It worked somewhat. Mm-hmm. You know, people valiantly will do that. But what happened was they would just start a little thing in a church basement, you know,
yep.
and they would have an open mic at the high school, or they would do a library program. And it was through those projects that they built up. And I don't think anybody foresaw the success. And then when the food movement came in, which is so necessarily regional and close to the ground wherever you are, mm-hmm. and all that kind of branding happened, which of course is kind of a 21st century word.
Right, right.
You know, there was sort of inadvertent branding. It was fantastic. And you know who I thank for some of this? George W. Bush. I feel like when his government came in, there was this kind of, you're in it alone, guys. Like, you don't have a government that's going to really care about a lot of stuff. And so, and Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma made a huge difference. People started to, it got people back into kind of looking at food chains and systems. And that was probably one of the strongest ways that I saw people really transforming in Pennsylvania and Kansas and Iowa.
Yeah. And one of the striking things about everything you just said is how that is so analogous to what your career in the mid-90s was like. You know, it was like no one expected the success that you had with those records. And it wasn't done with a big, you know, the equivalent of a big box store behind you. There wasn't a major. It was a small independent label. You were doing it, you know, basically in the musical equivalent of church basements.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And maybe literally yeah. church basements.
Plenty of those. You know, and then if you're lucky, you got up to the main hall of the Unitarian Church. And well, I think there was a parallel path and then an actual crossover, because there was this incredible, my booking agency were these guys, and people would call up and say, I really want to have a concert series, and I'll give the artist 100% of the proceeds. And they'd say, no, give our artist 75% and take the rest and shovel it right back into keeping your series strong. And they groomed a whole bunch of presenters and promoters across the country. And these are people who weren't necessarily assertive in some ways when they started, and they became kind of empresarios in their towns. Mm. It was such a great grapevine movement, a real people's movement in music happening in the late 90s. I was lucky in every way. And then there was like this, if we use this thing called the internet, we can talk to each other and we don't have to wait for a magazine to tell us. And all of these grapevines and radio presenters were also talking to each other and cutting out the middleman. So there was everything based on what was organically sticking.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I was in the wake of Ani DeFranco.
Ani DeFranco, yeah.
Going through, as I say, she brought the scream back to acoustic music. So I really lucked out on that. I have to thank Ani for a lot of this.
Yeah. And also Joan Baez.
Oh, yeah. And actually, this album, the release of the album was opening for her, and it was extraordinary. And so was the training she gave me in how to be a better, you know, person on the road.
Which is not the same thing as being a better person in normal circumstances. I mean, because the road is its own life, isn't it?
Yes. First of all, yeah. Like, people are like, what did Joan Baez teach you? I'm like, she taught me that there's this thing called stretch velvet, and it doesn't wrinkle, and it's great, and it shows up really nicely in the light. And they're like, what did she tell you about justice? And she never talked about that. But when you'd get people at a table talking, somebody said, oh, you know, remember when Vaclav Havel said that you were one of the two or three, you know, factors in their having a nonviolent revolution in Czechoslovakia? And she's like, oh, yeah. So I learned from the people around her what a difference.
Yeah.
And I also heard her in an interview where they said, well, you get involved with causes. And she said, you know, You have to get involved with something besides just your music. It's just not enough when you're on the road all the time. The Me Show can be, it's not sustainable. And she was right.
Yeah. Well, so revisiting this period of time, 1996, 20 years ago, when Dar Williams' album Mortal City was released. And so this is the meat and potatoes of the current tour, most of the tour around the States, including three nights here in New York at City Winery, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, the 22nd through the 24th. Dar and her band are here with us in the Soundcheck studio. We started, Dar, with, you know, one of the big electric numbers from the album. You want to do one of the ballads from the record next?
Yes, absolutely. This is one that Joan Baez covered. I remember she brought me into the studio and they just put the headphones on me and watched me have an emotional reaction. Like, okay, let's watch Dar now. And this is called February.
Halfway down in the ice, They froze up so quickly, the keys and their owners. Even after the anger, it all turned silent then. Every day turned solitary, so we came to February. First we forgot where we'd planted those bulbs last year, and then we forgot that we'd planted it all. Then we forgot what plants are all together, and I blamed you for my freezing and forgetting. And the nights were long and cold and scary. Can we live through February? Christmas was a long red glare, shut up like a warning. We gave presents without cards, and then the snow, and then the snow came. We were always a shoveling, and we dropped to sleep exhausted, and we wake up and it's snowing. So long that it lasted into March and found us walking a path alone together. You stopped and pointed and you said, "That's crocus." And I said, "What's a crocus?" And you said, "It's a flower." I tried to remember, but I said, "What's a flower?" Said, I still love you. The leaves were turning as we drove to the hardware store. My new lover made me keys to the house. And when we got home, well, we just started chopping wood. 'Cause you never know how next year'll be. And we'll gather all our arms can carry. I am lost to February.
Dar Williams with her song February from the 1996 album Mortal City. Dar is celebrating the 20th anniversary of that breakthrough record, touring around City Winery Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. John Jackson on violin there, Bryn Roberts on keyboard, and Ethan Eubanks contributing silence from behind the drum kit for that one. With the obvious, there are some obvious changes over the years, Dar. John's violin part replacing what was originally a cello on the record. But coming back to these songs 20 years later, how have they changed for you?
They've all, you know, it's difficult for me because to be pessimistic about the country, you know, I try, but by the indications of how edgy these songs were and how edgy they're not now, everything's really become more inclusive in this country. That's all I see.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
More sustainable and more thoughtful in terms of people participating, you know, at the commons. And maybe that's because I was in the 90s when things were just starting to begin, and it was tough.
And you do still tour a lot.
I do.
including lots of colleges and stuff. Are you seeing, you know, the youngest voters, you know, the 18, 21, 25? I mean, are they more engaged politically? Are they more engaged in their communities? What do you see?
Well, I teach a course, so I see it's, you know, they're sort of nicer. They're nicer by nature, which is kind of like they're, or I should say, you know, they call me Professor Williams. Anyway.
This is at Wesleyan?
Yeah. And I bring food. I bring donuts every week, you know, for the middle. And they go like, Professor Williams, do you want us to bring the food? And I'm like, I can't even imagine offering to show up with, even noticing that the professor was bringing food. I'd just be like, oh, food. You know, when I was in college, like that, this idea of like us and them, we are the students, those are the grown-ups. We are, you know, the school, that is the town. I mean, there's still a lot of that, but that kind of looseness mm-hmm. with people my age, I mean, maybe just me, but that looseness and kids understanding that they can be part of a conversation with grown-ups about solutions and that kind of empowerment, that's new. And I think they understand that things are up to them.
Well, you know, the last time you were here, Dar, was for your 2012 record In the Time of Gods, where you took on a lot of the big issues that are still facing us, but sort of cloaked in Greek mythology, the characters and the tales of the Greek classics. And, you know, it sort of makes, I mean, it's easy to look back to 1996, 20 years, and say, wow, it was a different world back then. But if you look back 20 years or 2,000 years to the ancient Greeks, the world's not so different in a lot of big ways.
No. I mean, in a kind of wonderful, we still have, you know, we're at the end of the day, and this is great about Greek mythology, and maybe this is just the way Western people see things now still, but, you know, you have, you have that committee table in your head, you know, and you're talking to your greed, and you're talking to your selflessness and your selfishness, and you have to have this little meeting every morning about who's going to have the voice, and it's just a very. But maybe it's more like ancient Greece now than it was, because it's such an interior time. Mm. You know, we check in with ourselves. You know, and which is another nice thing. People sort of. Somebody, I was talking about the 60s, and somebody said, you know what the 60s gave us? The ability to be self-reflective and apologize. You know, be like, hey, my bad. And you didn't have to stand so rigidly in your own opinion about things. Like, yeah, I can see it that way, you know. I don't know if that was related to the drugs but, you know, kind of entertaining other ways of looking at stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and allowing you know, yourself to live amongst others. Maybe that was something that was really important in Athens and now important in New York City.
And sort of important to the characters of this next song.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good segue, Jim. In fact, let's dedicate this song to everybody who has not sort of surrendered to, or has not fallen for religious discrimination.
All right. This song, and this is one you have been playing over the years.
Yeah, yeah. No, it comes up. I mean, you know, I'd like to say I play it the holidays, but I play it all the summer. People request it a bunch.
Yeah. The song is The Christians and the Pagans. It's another song originally from that 20-year-ago record, Mortal City, but here's another live performance by Dar Williams and her band.
Her uncle said, we're up here for the holiday. Jane and I were having solstice. Now we need a place to stay. And her Christ-loving uncle watched his wife hang Mary on a tree. He watched his son hang candy canes all made with red dye number 3. He told his niece, it's Christmas Eve. I know our life is not your style. She said, Christmas is like solstice, and we miss you, and it's been a so the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Just before to all their gods and goddesses. The food was great, the tree plugged in, the meal had gone without a hitch, till Timmy turned to Amber and said, "Is it true that you're a witch?" His mom jumped up and said, "The pies are burning," and she hit the kitchen. And it was Jane who spoke. She said, "It's true, your cousin's not a Christian. But we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share. And you find magic from your God, and we find magic everywhere." So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. And where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning. Now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning. Her aunt said, "Really, no, don't bother." Amber's uncle saw how Amber looked like Tim and like her father. He thought about his brother, how they hadn't spoken in a year. He thought he'd call him up and say, "It's Christmas and your daughter's here." He thought of father's sons and brothers, saw his own son tuck his sleeves in. "Can I be a pagan?" Dad said, "We'll discuss it when they leave." So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Finding trees in darkness, learning new ways from the old, and making sense of history and drawing warmth out of the
That is The Christians and the Pagans from Dar Williams and her band, John Jackson, this time on mandolin, Bryn Roberts on keyboards, Ethan Eubanks on the drums, Dar, of course, singing and playing guitar. And, you know, it's great to have a song with that kind of vintage now, 20 years old. It still sounds as current as it was when it was written. I mean, maybe that's not a good thing.
Well, know? it's interesting because sometimes I change the names of the religion at the end, and people really respond to that because you hear them. That's one thing you get after performing in a while. Sometimes you can read their thoughts. You hear them listening to it in a certain way after certain events, and people really take a lot of solace reminding themselves that they're so capable of this, even at these American dinner tables where things can get kind of contentious. So, it's a nice check-in point, and especially at the holidays and for this country. So, yeah, I think it's we'll probably always need that. That's okay.
Yeah. So you're touring around with Mortal City. What happens with, you know, I mean, do you come back next year with End of the Summer, you know, the 97 record?
People are like, okay, you did the Honesty Room, and then you did, and now you're doing the second album. Why are you doing the second album? It's because it did better than the Honesty It did the best of all. I mean, it was the most breakout, as you say, of the records. And I perform about eight of the 11 songs still, like they're all in my thing and my set list, and that's a really big deal. This was the one. Clearly something happened. Honesty Room gave me the courage to do this album, and this album was, my feet were pretty firmly planted, and then, you know, I got all arrogant and crazy, and so the rest of the album's whatever, but no. But this somehow stood in its time in a certain way and evolved a certain way, and so we're doing this one for that reason.
Well, so that's at City Winery Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. It is the 20th anniversary of Mortal City, the Dar Williams record, and she's touring it around the country this fall. It's been great having you and the band here with us back on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Can you fix this? It's a broken heart. It was fine, but it just fell apart.
That does it for this edition of the Soundcheck podcast, but there's much more on our website, our weekly music roundup, our daily gig alerts, and of course, our Soundcheck podcasts, bringing you live music and videos and lots more. That's at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.
Like a pair of angel wings, you are my family. You are my family. We stood outside in the summer rain, different people.